I'm from California, so I came ill-prepared to come to D.C. with hardly any winter clothes, so apologize about that. And I also decided to do my self-guided walking tour on Saturday when it was snowing instead of yesterday, which was really sunny and nice. Okay, so here we go. So today I'm going to be talking about electronic direct-to-consumer advertising, and specifically pharmaceutical marketing in the social media space. Most of the presentations to this point have been about the potential efficacy of social media in public health interventions. And I'm going to go sort of the opposite way and talk about the potential risks for global health and public health issues for bad forms of social media marketing. Oh, I probably just used the mouse, right? That's better. Okay, thanks. And I also want to disclose that I'm a poor grad student. So I do have a fellowship with the Partnership for Safe Medicines. They deal with counterfeit drugs. And the reason why we provide this disclosure is because we will be talking about counterfeit drugs during this presentation. So I just want to go over a brief primer of direct-to-consumer advertising. I'm pretty sure most of you are aware of what direct-to-consumer advertising is. But some quick facts. The United States and New Zealand are the only two countries which actually allow statutorily direct-to-consumer advertising to patients. And what that is, of course, is that pharmaceutical companies are allowed to promote their products to the patients, not just to the physicians. And most countries only allow promotion to physicians. Another fact, 91%, this was a survey done a few years ago, show that about 91% of people have been exposed to direct-to-consumer advertising. This is actually probably underreported because this was traditional types of forms of media like television, radio, magazines, etc. But of course, with the digital explosion, that prevalence is probably a lot higher. Here's the NasonXB. He's kind of my favorite direct-to-consumer advertising one. He's got a French accent. It's like the Ronald McDonald of nasal inhalers. So I'm not exactly sure why they used him, but he's an example of a caricature that would maybe influence your purchasing of this particular type of product. Another important part of information is that 330% represents the increase in pharmaceutical marketing expenditure for this particular category from 1996 to 2005. I'd be willing to bet that's grown, but pharmaceutical marketing data is really hard to get, especially segmented out for different types of spend, so it's really hard to assess how much the industry is actually spending in this space. Now, we have to talk about the alleged benefits and the negative potential impacts of DTCA. So the industry a lot of times promotes DTCA as a way to empower consumers to make good healthcare choices. It also potentially helps them improve patient adherence to clinical treatment and serves patients with underdiagnosed or otherwise rare diseases. From this ad, you can sort of see a very empowered patient. He's a formidable man, and the clot is no match for him. So again, empowering patients to really make decisions, and this is also part of the shifting dynamic of the physician-patient relationship. It's becoming less paternalistic and more about the consumer demanding healthcare services. And so this is an example of that changing dynamic. Of course, we also have to talk about the potential negative consequences, which include that consumer demand increases demand for potentially ineffectual or dangerous pharmaceuticals. Sometimes, the ads you see, they may misrepresent the risk versus benefits. If you see people in a tub talking about Viagra the whole time, and they're in a very serene environment, and then it runs through the risk section really fast, it's really hard to determine if that's a balanced reporting of risk versus benefits. It may lead to off-label use of drugs, may lead to also risky behavior, such as purchasing drugs online, which we'll go over in this presentation. So one of the reasons why direct-to-consumer advertising is such a big issue is because it's really hard to regulate. First of all, the FDA doesn't have any of the resources it needs or the staff to go through every single ad, every single television spot, or even what goes on the internet to really determine if there's balanced or fair reporting. So this leads to self-policing by the industry, which is fraught with potential conflicts of interest, of course. Also, legal challenges are unlikely due to the fact that direct consumer advertising is considered commercial free speech protected under the First Amendment. So just like we have free speech rights, commercial entities also do under a little bit of a different doctrine. U.S. legislation to limit certain direct-to-consumer advertising to make it so that you can't engage in direct-to-consumer advertising when a product is initially released have failed so far. And it's also important to note that this is a global problem. There's studies showing that cross-border direct-to-consumer advertising, and what that means is direct-to-consumer advertising that originated in the United States but somehow crosses a border. So an example of this would be U.S. commercials, and Canadians buy cable TV, I guess, in Canada, and satellite TV, and they get exposed. And studies have shown that this leads to an increase in prescribing of certain types of drugs that are promoted. Europe has tried to, there's been calls in Europe to lift the ban on DTCA, which was recently rejected by 22 of the 27 EU member states. In New Zealand, the other country which allows direct-to-consumer advertising, a lot of physicians are against it, a lot of healthcare practitioners are against it, and a ban has not yet come into place. So I think the concentration of this presentation and sort of the context of this session is the changing dynamic of social media and digital marketing, what we call electronic direct-to-consumer advertising, which is this new paradigm. First, we have three different phases of that, and the first one we like to call is online DTCA, just static or web 1.0 advertising. It's very static. It's just a product web page, just sends information to you, and you consume it. And then the next phase of that would be direct-to-consumer advertising 2.0 or Web 2.0 technologies, which utilize interactive web content such as social media, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, where you interact and you sort of commune with a message and you actively participate. And then the third level of that would be mobile, which is an area where I think there's not too much research, and as we continuously start to use mobile devices, that's another avenue for, you know, advertising to us about the promotion of drugs. This picture on the right, actually on the left, sorry, is one I pulled from a direct-to-consumer advertising trade pub. And it says, campaigns are so big they can't fit on a single screen. TV, computer, and of course mobile. So industry knows about these opportunities and they're going to actively pursue them. So the study we conducted was, we just wanted to assess what the prevalence of electronic direct-to-consumer advertising was. We did a simple descriptive study using Google searches for the prevalence of EDTCA in the top 10 pharmaceutical companies, so the companies that make the most money, and the top 10 grossing drugs, the drugs that make the most money for the pharmaceutical companies. The results were that, just in general, and we'll talk about them in more detail, is that EDTCA use is very prevalent. There's hardly any regulation. It crosses borders and also can be associated with drugs with an elevated risk profile. Or safety profile. And the additional findings, which we found really interesting, were that EDTCA isn't just used by pharmaceutical companies, but it's also used by illicit actors, mostly online pharmacies, which often sell drugs without the need of a prescription and are often counterfeit products, so they can be very dangerous for patients. The full results have been published in the Journal of Medical Information Research, so if you're interested, you can go there for more information. The main findings, so we talk about pharma companies first, is that all of them, all of the top 10, have Facebook, Twitter, Friendster, sponsored blogs, and RSS feeds. So they all are involved in social media at one level. And Facebook being the largest player in this group, they're all actively involved in social media. 80% have YouTube channels, so those are channels that are directly associated with the manufacturer. It's a dedicated channel for their particular company, and 80% actually have some type of mobile application on iTunes. So the results of this data is that a lot of pharmaceutical companies are actively pursuing this space. A lot of times this information is non-branded, so it's about a particular health issue, but I mean, the only reason why a pharmaceutical company would spend money in that space is to lead to revenue through hopefully prescribing of drugs in that disease space. So there's a business case for that. Some examples, we have Pfizer's social media space page. It's really robust. It has links to YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, all of those things. We've got Merck's Facebook page. I don't know how many people are following. That's about 1,000, so that's not really all that good. But, you know, I think probably investors and some patients will probably follow them. Roche has their Twitter page where they talk about new drugs that come out. So they may say, oh, we got a new drug approved, check it out, things like that. And then GSK has their YouTube channel. So when we talk about the top grossing drugs, drugs that make the most money globally, 90% had product-specific pages. So that means, and the implication of this is that a lot of these websites are global. So they're on the internet, and anyone can access them from many different countries. Maybe China would be difficult because they have a lot of search parameters and filters on their search engines, but I was overseas a few times, I checked them out, they're all available. And technically speaking, direct-to-consumer advertising is only allowed in the U.S., in New Zealand. But if you put it online, it's pretty much everywhere. And some of these websites even have a disclaimer saying, if you're not in the U.S., don't pay attention to this information. Which is kind of, you know, good, nice try, but I really don't think that's an issue. You know, you're going to have access to it no matter what, and you're promoting drugs globally. And it's a lot better than the TV or radio ads, you know, things like that. You can put it on the web, and it's out there right away. 70% of these products had specific Facebook pages, and the problem here is, in this data, what we tried to tease out is we couldn't really determine who originally posted some of this information. So as a consumer, you don't really know, is this Facebook page by Pfizer or is it by some guy that just wants to, you know, talk about Lipitor? A lot of times it might be even a guy that's funded by the pharmaceutical company. So it's really hard to tell. That's a problem in this space. And 80% had, you know, the NasonXB, you can find him on YouTube now. So the direct-to-consumer advertising, the actual ads are now globalized as well. So some examples. We have the Lipitor product-specific page with some advertisements about copay card. That's nice. We have a Facebook page for Astrovastatin, which is Lipitor. It's really hard to tell if this is Pfizer or not. I couldn't tell, but a lot of these pages look pretty authentic. We have some Twitter posts about how great Lipitor is. I don't know who Twitters about Lipitor and how great it is. So I have my suspicions about, you know, who's funding these spaces, and you know, I just don't think many patients are that interested. And they can be advocates, but there's also what's called consumer opinion leaders, which are now people that are consumer-based, are consumers, like the rest, all of us, and they're paid by the drug companies to promote products. So there's no transparency. And of course, we have Dr. Jarvik's Lipitor commercial. This is sort of famous because it shows him rowing a boat very vigorously, and it turns out it was a stunt double. So there were some issues. There's some congressional hearings about whether direct-to-consumer advertising is misleading. They say he's the inventor of the heart valve or the artificial heart. He's not really, you know. So you can see him online, though, and any country can take a look at him. And the additional findings, some more additional findings were that we really looked at the safety profile. So in this category, we looked at the drugs that had the highest spending of direct-to-consumer advertising based on Nielsen data. And we found that 90% of them were either subject to a black box warning, which means significant patient risk, potential death for patients if used for the wrong indication, or some recall or other safety notification. And you can see about black box warnings looks about, you know, about more than half. So a lot of these drugs, unfortunately, are at high risk because pharmaceutical companies promote a drug very early in the product life cycle. They want to get the consumer base solidified. Because when patent expiration comes, they got to turn the business over to the generics. So they really want to get that customer loyalty at the very beginning of the product life cycle. Problem is, very poor post-market surveillance at that point. Maybe pharmacovigilance hasn't gone through. So a lot of these drugs end up getting actually recalled, like Vioxx. Vioxx would be a good example. And Zyprexa had safety issues as well. So a lot of these drugs that are heavily promoted are also have a compromised safety and risk profile. This isn't the first work on this. Mintz and colleagues did it on Canadian cross-border promotion, and they found similar results. And then the most important findings that I found is I was doing these searches with my colleague, and we found that a lot of online pharmacies that promote drugs with no prescription, you just go online, you buy them, and you don't know what you're going to get. It could be substandard, it could be fake, it could have high levels of toxicity. They're also using social media. They're using Facebook. And why not? It's a very lucrative business model. They can make a lot of money, and social media is a lot cheaper than putting your ad on the television, and there's less regulation. So we found that 90% of the top 10 DTCA spending drugs had illicit eDTCA links. 60% and 50% prevalence on Facebook. So, thank you. And I'm almost done. So it's talking about, you know, Facebook is actively engaged, I would argue, in the promotion of these type of products because they're not regulating that space, but there's reasons behind that. So I think the best way to illustrate this is with pictures. On the right, there's a Canadian pharmacy, no prescription required, the profile picture is sort of shady, if you ask me. But, I mean, it's no prescription. It's on Facebook. Here's another one. It says Canadian Healthcare. You found it. Click here to enter our drugstore. Here's a Twitter post talking about buying Symbicort without a prescription. And Friendster, which we included because they're declining in social media prevalence, but they're heavily, I think they still have a lot of users in Asia when we did the study. So we wanted to have a very global assessment of this problem. So this is still out there. I did searches just recently. They're still out there. So you can check out Facebook online pharmacies if you want, and there's a lot of them. Conclusions, online DTCA is growing among both licit and illicit actors. So both types of entities are using this type of social media to promote their products, I guess you could say. DTCA 2.0 communicates direct to patients. So because patients are using social networking, they may be more influenced by someone recommending them to a site to promote a drug or recommending that they go to this online pharmacy because it's a social network, and we feel that that is an elevated risk for patients. And there's absolutely no regulation. So Facebook's not doing anything about it. FDA is not doing anything about it. Nobody really knows what to do about the social media space, especially in public health, this bad form. And also consumers are moving towards this digital environment. So 51% of people on a Harris poll said that they now search for information online, health information online, so they could potentially go to these sites as well. And the FDA has said that it's not going to regulate this space. And then finally, the last slide is we have a policy proposal out there, and the first part of it is to prevent the export of the DTCA, so say to pharmaceutical companies, you can't send this out to anything outside of the U.S., and have Facebook and companies like that actually regulate this. Increase transparency so you know the sources of electronic consumer advertising, so you know if it's authentic or not. And, of course, promotion of evidence-based DTCA, which, you know, like a lot of the presenters have already shown, social media can be effective, but we should promote evidence-based direct-to-consumer advertising, not these questionable forms. So thank you very much.